Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, who discusses the Women's Walk for Peace that she recently participated in that crossed the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea. College student Sydney Grange, who explains why she participated in a civil disobedience action at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in protest of that agency's policies promoting the extraction of natural gas. And Jean Ross of the National Nurses United Union, who talks about the recent introduction of two bills in the U.S. Senate, the Robin Hood Tax and the College for All Act, that together would fund free tuition at the nation's public colleges and universities. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Recently, at the high-profile National Sanitation Conference at Durban's International Convention Center, South Africa's Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa told the audience that a child dies every 20 seconds in the world due to poor sanitation, resulting in more deaths than from AIDS, malaria, and measles combined. Inadequate sanitation easily transmits several infectious diseases like cholera, typhoid, and polio. After Bill Gates visited Durban and discovered that 1 million people, or one-third of the population, had no access to adequate sanitation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2011 funded $1.6 million into research grants for development of sustainable sanitation. However, at the same time, Bill Gates has financial interest in fossil fuels and petrochemical companies that the residents of Durban say are causing other problems like asthma, and the area is known locally as Cancer Alley. But according to the Guardian newspaper, Bill Gates has yet to show any interest in diseases linked to pollution generated by the Shell and British Petroleum refineries that the Gates Foundation is heavily invested in, and are located only a short drive away from the Durban Convention Complex. The local residents say that for Bill Gates to be a true philanthropist, he should divest from fossil fuel companies. The town of Missoula, Montana, which inspired the novel A River Runs Through It, has gone to court to gain control over the local water utility, Mountain Water Company, which is owned by the global asset management firm The Carlyle Group. For 2 years, Missoula, a community of 70,000 people, has attempted to purchase the water company, but the Carlyle Group ignored their offers. A few months after the city filed an eminent domain lawsuit against Carlyle, the private equity firm announced it was selling Mountain Water to Canadian-based Algonquin Power and Utility Corporation for $327 million. If the town prevails in court, it would create a powerful example for water activists across the U.S. Hermina Harold of Missoula told the news magazine In These Times, "Privatization is a frightening global trend that has constricted people's access to water." She's hoping the current court case sets a legal precedent that will help other communities win control over their water. Missoula City Councilman Jason Weiner, who supports municipal ownership of Mountain Water, believes that area residents should have a stake in local resources if they're going to chart their own future. In a quiet suburb outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, sits the law office of David Langdon, one of the most secretive political dark money players in the U.S. today. According to the Center for Public Integrity, Langdon is a well-connected, behind-the-scenes lawyer experienced at secretly moving political money around through his network of right-wing nonprofit groups and super PACs. Since the 2010 election, 11 groups connected to Langdon have raised and spent a combined $22 million in federal, state, and ballot initiative campaigns. Two groups, Citizens for a Working America and its super PAC, spent $2.2 million during the 2012 presidential campaign. Langdon won fame in 2004 when he was the lead author of an Ohio State constitutional amendment that defined marriage as a union between a man and a woman, which was overwhelmingly approved by Ohio voters. More recently, Langdon has represented Tea Party groups in their lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service over perceived bias in how conservative organizations' applications for tax-exempt status were handled. Questions are now being raised about Langdon's possible role in strategically moving money to defeat Republican Ohio Senator Rob Portman, who 2 years ago reversed his previous position and endorsed same-sex marriage. Langdon is exploiting the secrecy legalized by the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling to build his network of right-wing groups to raise and spend millions of dollars without disclosing his donors. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
A group of 30 international women activists crossed the demilitarized zone from North to South Korea on May 24th in a symbolic effort to diminish the enmity between these two nations that have been divided for 70 years. Although the Korean War ended in 1953 with the signing of an armistice agreement, no final peace settlement has been negotiated between the North and South, which remain officially at war. The Peace Walk Project, called Women Cross DMZ, includes longtime American feminist Gloria Steinem and two Nobel Peace laureates, Mairead McGuire of Northern Ireland and Lema Bowie of Liberia. The group, which called for an end to the Korean War and for a new beginning for a reunified Korea, held international peace symposiums in the North Korean capital of Pyongyang and South Korea's capital, Seoul. The decades-long separation of many Korean families is but one of the painful unresolved issues of the divided nation. As the delegation of peace walkers entered South Korea, they were greeted both by supporters and opponents, some of whom protested what they viewed as the activists' exploitation by North Korea's authoritarian regime that has often been cited for gross human rights violations. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who participated in the peace walk. Here she discusses the goals of the Women's Walk for Peace and the story she heard on both sides of the border about the ongoing pain of the Korean War that cost the lives of 4 million people.
Well, Christine Ahn is a Korean-American who really has been working on this for a long time and put together an amazing group of 30 women. It was wonderful traveling with Gloria Steinem, I must say, at 81 years old. She is just a phenomena. People were saying, because she was often our spokesperson, who would spontaneously be asked to say things. And in our group, there was a joke because somebody said, boy, you know, I wish I could speak like that when I'm 81. And we were all saying, we wish we could speak like that now. Because she would just summarize the whole situation in a very profound and diplomatic kind of way. And we had two Nobel laureates with us. We had several Korean Americans, some of whom, like Susie Kim, an historian, worked on these issues at Rutgers University for years. But we had people from 12 different countries represented. We had a woman from Zimbabwe, from Colombia, from Mexico, from Sweden. It was quite an extraordinary group of women.
And what was the objective of the action crossing the border, the DMZ?
We wanted to highlight the fact that there is still an unresolved major issue that has kept millions of families from seeing each other. Imagine there's an artificial border that the superpowers, and it was the time in the Soviet Union and the U.S., decided upon. And it has kept the North and South divided now for 70 years. There are people who are in their 80s now who haven't been able to see their brothers, their sisters, their other relatives for 70 years. There was a brief time when there were some family visits were being allowed, but now the governments are back to being very hostile towards each other, and no more family visits are allowed. We were the third international group ever to cross from one Korea into the other Korea in 70 years.
I had read that the extraordinary thing about that was that you got the authorization from both North and South Korea to cross the border, to cross the DMZ. What's the significance of that, do you think?
Well, there's another piece of it is you have to get the permission from the UN that is in charge of that border, and the U.S. controls the UN there. So we had to get the U.S. involved. I mean, there are many moving parts of all of this. Actually, the North Koreans were more open to this project than the South Koreans were. It's probably above the heads of most of the listeners But it turned out to be an important issue that there were two possible crossings. One is where the armistice was signed, which would have been a more symbolic place to cross, and that's where we wanted to cross. And one is where there's an industrial zone. The only relationship between the North and South has been a business relationship and in the industrial zone, and that's where the South Koreans wanted us to cross. In the end, we were forced to cross there. But it is interesting that we got more cooperation from the North than the South.
There was some criticism and I think even some protests when you crossed the border over into South Korea, criticism that somehow the North Korean government was somehow exploiting the march for their own propaganda purposes. I don't know how you respond to that. I think a further issue they were talking about when it came to women, that women in the North have been reported by human rights organizations to have been subject to rape, murder, and torture specifically. And how did you respond to those folks who saw your action differently than, of course, your intent?
You know, I've worked a lot on the issue of Cuba, and I just loved it when President Obama finally said, after 50 years of a policy that hasn't worked, it's time to try something different. And then in the case of Korea, we can say after 70 years of a policy that hasn't worked, it's time to try something different. And so we were the citizen diplomats, and we weren't there to support the North Korean government, the South Korean government. We were there to support peace. And I think while the North might have tried to exploit us for their means, the South, and particularly those in the South that don't want to see reconciliation, were trying to do the same. And I think we managed to stay above the fray and to keep the mantra that we are there as peacemakers. We are there as citizens. We never asked to meet with government officials. We didn't ask to meet with policymakers. And that we are representing what the Korean women can't do themselves, which is speak to each other. And in fact, we had minders in the North, and some people called them assistants or translators. Call them what you will. When we went to say goodbye to them, it was full of tears and hugs, and they were real people that we came to like a lot. And the person who was my interpreter, as we were leaving, the last thing she said is, please give our love to the South Korean sisters. So on both sides, we really felt this tremendous longing to be one country, to have the armistice be converted into a peace treaty, and to figure out a way to meld these two countries that have not only been separated for all these years arbitrarily, but also now have regimes that are so different from each other. And, you know, how do you reconcile that? But it has to be done. And unfortunately now, it's people who do not have North or South Korean passports that can do this.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace. Find more information and commentary on the Korean Women's Walk for Peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From May 21st to 29th, about 200 people from all over the eastern U.S. participated in protest actions called Stop the Furcus, which was organized by the group Beyond Extreme Energy. Climate activists protested each morning outside the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's Washington, D.C. headquarters. FERC, as it's known, was the target of protests because the agency has approved almost all corporate applications seeking permits for interstate frack gas pipelines, polluting compressor stations, gas storage facilities, and liquefied natural gas, or LNG, export terminals. The rush to drill, transport, and burn natural gas through the resource-intensive and dangerous practice of fracking is putting communities and families at risk all over the country. Climate activists believe natural gas is a dangerous climate killer because the main component of natural gas is methane, which has 86 times more impact on global warming than does carbon dioxide. On May 27th, five people were arrested when they refused police orders to move from blocking the FERC office door in an effort to keep employees out and bring home to them the harmful impacts of fracking. One of those arrested was Sydney Grange, a 19-year-old student at Warren Wilson College in Asheville, North Carolina. Grange and four other protesters were held in jail for 30 hours, a much longer time than dozens of others who were arrested at FERC last fall. Ultimately, charges were dropped against the five when the head of the federal police agency responsible for arresting them stated that the arrests had been a mistake. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sidney Grange outside of FERC's offices just before the student activists returned to North Carolina. Here, Grange explains why she participated in the civil disobedience action and the importance of the climate change movement to future generations.
My name's Sidney Grange. I'm originally from California, outside of San Francisco area, and now I'm living in North Carolina, where I'm studying conservation biology and environmental policy.
Okay, so you were one of five people who was arrested. You were blocking the doors to FERC with a bigger group of other people, and when the police announced that they would start arresting people if they didn't move on the third warning, and also said that it would not be what the police did last fall, which was just to take people to the next building, process them in 10 minutes, and fine them $50, but that you would actually be arrested and taken to jail for processing, you decided to stand your ground. Explain what your thought process was and your emotional process.
Yeah, well, it was definitely a hard decision to make. I wasn't really sure about what was at stake. Yeah, but I looked over and saw Steve and others standing strong despite these consequences that were mentioned. And I just decided I wanted to stand up for what I knew was right, and I wanted to stand in solidarity with them and stand in solidarity with all the communities that are being affected by FERC. So I decided to just stay.
And then just describe a little bit what happened, because you were actually held quite a bit longer than other people who've even been arrested in these situations.
Yeah, so we were expecting to be released, or I was expecting to be released within like 2 to 5 hours after they finished processing. However, the processing took longer than they intended or expected, and because we missed the processing deadline, we ended up being held overnight. And I was pretty unaware of what was going on throughout the whole time. The system wasn't very good at informing us of where we were going or when we would be going there, etc.
And of the five people, there were two females and three males. So were you with your fellow arrestee?
Yeah, luckily I was with Jerry the whole time. It was great to get to reflect and talk with her and kind of be together in the situation.
And I know that a lot of people who do these kind of actions have certain dietary restrictions or commitments. I don't know if you do, but it just I know that can be a challenge. So
yeah.
Talk about that.
They only had one meal to serve us the whole time. Bologna sandwiches or cheese sandwiches. I'm a vegetarian who prefers to eat vegan. So it wasn't that flexible of a meal to deal with. I ended up just eating the bread, which was fine. I feel bad for those who are gluten-free or have celiacs or something. Definitely aren't many meal options available.
Talk a little bit about your commitment, you know, why you came to this action, and what you hope, you know, will come out of it.
Yeah, well, the climate crisis is just so present, so yeah, it's affecting everyone everywhere, and to hear about FERC and what it's doing to all these communities is just very devastating, and to see that these pipelines and this infrastructure is coming from this one specific agency makes it pretty clear that we should be standing up here, right at their headquarters. And yeah, I just wanted to stand in solidarity with the communities, the frontline communities that are most affected, as well as take a stand for climate justice in the more general perspective, too.
So this particular part of the movement is really made up, not totally, but really heavily of people under 30 and people over 60.
Right.
And, you know, as someone who, and I'm in one demographic and you're in the other, but I definitely have a different timeline than somebody who's 19. So, I mean, how does it feel to you? Do you feel hopeless, or do you feel like, you know, there is still a chance? Do you feel like enough of your peers are involved?
I mean, the issue of climate change is definitely daunting. However, being here and being with this group has actually been very empowering. I love the mix of different generations and how we can each use our knowledge and come together for a common cause. I found that pretty powerful. So although I can definitely get down on climate change sometimes, it's important to just like connect with those who care about the same issues and to take a stand.
And what do you think it will be your next step?
Just to continue to be involved with the people I've met here and the issues I've learned about here. Yeah, and to remain involved at school and draw some resources I've gained and learned about here and bring those back to school and hopefully get some more students involved.
That was college student Sidney Grange, who was arrested with four other activists during protests at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission headquarters. Find more information on local and national campaigns targeting the natural gas industry by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Vermont's independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders launched his campaign for president twice, once in Washington on April 30th, and more recently in Burlington, Vermont on May 26th, the city where he served as mayor from 1981 to 1989. In a speech to more than 5,000 supporters on the shores of Lake Champlain, Sanders discussed the serious challenges he says are facing the country and offered an agenda for America, calling for specific proposals to provide bold solutions. Sanders, who proudly describes himself as a democratic socialist, has been dismissed by many in the corporate media as a long-shot candidate for the White House in competition against former First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But in recent weeks, Bernie, as he's affectionately called by supporters, has surprised many political observers with larger-than-expected rallies drawing overflow crowds to hear his progressive message in Iowa and Minnesota. In keeping with his campaign pledge to offer bold solutions, Senator Sanders recently introduced two pieces of legislation in the U.S. Senate. One, the Robin Hood tax, a financial transaction tax similar to those that have been implemented in some 40 nations around the world, would set a 0.5% tax on most stock transactions and a lesser tax on bond and derivative trades. The second bill, called the College for All Act, funded by the Robin Hood tax, would provide for free undergraduate college tuition fees for students attending public colleges and universities, as well as tackling the student debt crisis. Your reporter spoke with Jean Ross, a registered nurse and co-president of the National Nurses United Union, a major supporter of the Robin Hood tax, along with a coalition of students, religious, and civil rights groups. Here Ross talks about the Robin Hood tax and how the revenue generated would help fund vital education and other social programs.
Well, we have kind of a platform that we came up with not long after we formed ourselves, which is in 2009, and it's called our Main Street Contract. And in it, we talk about really what the American dream ought to be from the perspective of nurses as we see it, but it turns out to be just what every American can and should expect. So we talk about the kinds of things that we want as a society, which is education for all, an equal good public education for all, a safety net for people who are ill, free, we call it Medicare for All, a new and improved Medicare for All, a secure retirement, a housing for everybody, a job for everyone who's willing and wants to work, that kind of thing. And in order to fund it, we came up with a financial transaction tax, which Keith Ellison introduced in the House, again reintroduced. It's called the Inclusive Prosperity Act. And now Bernie Sanders just introduced it in the Senate, but our favorite term for it is the Robin Hood tax. And what it is a very, very small tax on the riskiest of trades on Wall Street. And it is like 50 cents on $100. And that 0.5% tax can bring in up to $300 billion every year.
Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, now running for the Democratic Party nomination for president, has introduced two pieces of legislation in the Senate. One is the Robin Hood tax, and the other is the College for All Act. Maybe you can explain the relationship between these two bills and how they would work together.
A good public, free public education for all doesn't just stop at, you know, elementary school or high school. And so we know the money is there. It's just how we allocate it from this tax and any other that would, you know, you would choose to put forward. But for us, a free college education is entirely possible. Again, you know, and I've heard Bernie Sanders say this, people talk like all these things we're talking about are pie in the sky. We used to have free college education in this country. I believe it was Reagan that put the kibosh on that. So it's doable. It's just in, you know, where there's a will, there is a way. We live in the richest country in the world. There is no reason why young people who want to go to college and have an aptitude for it should not be able to go simply because they can't afford to go.
And so this tax, the Robin Hood tax, would fund college tuition for, is it state or public colleges all across the country?
I believe it's public. I believe it's public institutions. Now, not only that, it could do that for the bill that Bernie's put forward, but also we work with so many groups to try to put this Robin Hood tax forward. And I will tell you, it can do things like it could wipe out AIDS. It could totally wipe out AIDS on this planet, just a small portion of that $300 billion. It can do that. It could get free public education, just as Bernie put forward in his bill. It can make sure that Social Security is there and there to stay, and people can quit talking about what we're going to do with our poor. I mean, it's almost as if we're back into the Lyndon Johnson days, you know, the war on poverty, where our elderly were out in the street. This is ridiculous in a country as wealthy as ours.
I've heard arguments against the Robin Hood tax, the financial transaction tax, when it comes to the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and all that. Opponents say these people who trade stocks will just move elsewhere. They'll move to Shanghai. They'll move to Hong Kong. They'll move to this place or that place or Geneva. Is there any truth that, you know, to avoid this kind of taxation, the trades on Wall Street will dry up and people will lose their jobs?
Certainly not. It's a very lucrative business. They're not going anywhere. When they had it before, we didn't dry up and blow away. We had a very vibrant financial sector. It's just talking points meant to scare us. So there's really no good reason not to have it. We'd look at it like, you know, we pay taxes every day. Those of us who work for a living, we pay sales tax, for example. And these people are allowed to do this for business and pay nothing for a tax on it, time after time after time, millisecond after millisecond. That's ridiculous. The thing is, we as taxpayers have bailed them out over and over. And what we're asking for now is to just give the money back and put it where it belongs. It isn't as if we're asking to take from the rich and give to the poor. We are asking for that money that was taken from us to be given back and to continue to give back.
That was Jean Ross, a registered nurse and co-president of the National Nurses United Union. Find more information on the Robin Hood tax and related legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.